Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Farrier, who teaches at the University of Edinburgh, and we're talking about his book, Footprints, In Search of Future Fossils. David, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on.
This is a very unique project. What brought you to this project?
It was the sort of what's our legacy going to be, really. We're witnessing all these tremendous and often very troubling changes to the world we live in. And so many of them are going to have a very long lifespan, whether that's in terms of the carbon that we've put in the atmosphere that could linger there for as long as 100,000 years, or long-lived materials like nuclear waste and plastic. We're leaving a legacy that will be there, that will be legible, if we think about it in those terms, in the very deep future. So I wanted to think about, what is our legacy going to be? What marks are we leaving on the planet that will be here for generations far removed from our own, to see, and what might they make of us when they come across these finds and traces? So it's thinking about, what's our legacy going to be, and how does thinking about our legacy help us to be better ancestors, to take better care of the world we have right now.
And when you're talking deep future, you're talking about what will be left 1 million years or more from now.
Yeah, in some cases, definitely. Yeah, or even longer term than that. We're thinking about the likelihood of mega cities, cities like New York or Shanghai leaving a fossil, then we could be thinking in terms of 100 million years or more.
The interesting thing is that you teach English literature, and that gives you a totally different perspective. First of all, there are a lot of literature references in the book, which I found really fascinating. And there's almost a more poetic approach to the material, which I found really wonderful. I found it a lot more interesting than if we were to just have, some environmentalist, which you could be an environmentalist too. But you know what I'm saying? That you bring a whole different perspective to this.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. That was the idea. I mean, the central idea in the book is this idea of the future fossil, this legacy trace of us. But as I was writing it, it very much became apparent to me that what I was really talking about was stories. And in some cases, these are stories that leave a kind of material trace, an impression in the rock record, or a chemical trace. But really, whether we're thinking about carbon in the atmosphere or nuclear waste or plastic or changes to ocean chemistry, we're talking about stories. These effects that we're having on the planet are narratives. They tell stories about who we are, what we valued, what we didn't value. And so it seems natural, in a way, to reach for poetry, to reach for novels and stories to help think about what our legacy will be.
In your travels, you also came across what's already been lost. When you were in Australia and the bleached coral reefs that were there, and then you talked about the Baltic Sea and the huge area of anoxic water that's there. So what was sort of wild is that while you're making this search for fossils, there's stuff that's already been lost.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very much a kind of a two-part story, if you like. And I was thinking about what will be lost. As well as what will be left, absolutely. And in some cases, we can already see that loss unfolding, that absence opening up, whether it's in terms of biodiversity declining, or as you say, the really precarious future faced by coral reefs around the world. And I was very fortunate enough to be able to visit the Great Barrier Reef when I had some time in Australia and see some of the damage that's being done there already. When I was there, it was in the midst of the second serious bleaching event of recent times, and since then It suffered another bleaching event just recently. So things do not look good for the Great Barrier Reef. And that, of course, has for coral more widely, and that has implications for marine life across the ocean. Something like 25% of all marine life relies upon coral reefs for shelter, for food, for places to reproduce, and so on. So when people say we really need to look after sites like the Great Barrier Reef, that, you know, it's talking about looking after the oceans as a whole. And yeah, thinking about, you know, the losses we can already see accumulating really brought into sharp focus for me the importance of this kind of deep time perspective. Because, you know, once it's gone, it's gone.
Just to give the audience an example, I want to talk about the chapter of the Insatiable Road. You know, here we've built how many million miles of roads cover the planet? They're not going to last long.
Well, there are something like 50 million kilometers of roads circling the planet. Yeah. And, you know, they do many things. They connect. They allow materials to move from one side of the planet to the next. They cut through mountains, cliffs. They forge a path where a path really, you know, wouldn't otherwise go. And so they're a really interesting starting point for thinking about what our legacy will be in the rock record, what our planetary legacy will be, you know, over the course of the very deep future. And, you know, we're talking in the order of millions, tens of millions of years. Not a great deal of the surface road network will be left, maybe 1%. But
I think that's being generous. I mean, roads seem to be not – I mean, we have to replace the roads we've already laid down, like every 20 years. But what's fascinating, you bring this up, is that the roads are so important to in our sort of frame of mind. They loom large in our imagination. There are books like On the Road. They're found in poetry and art. I mean, roads are so important to us to give us this illusion of freedom. But here's this thing that we've laid down on the planet that's probably not going to last at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, the vast majority, you're right. I mean, when we're talking about anything that's left on the surface, ultimately it will be worn away, it will be eroded. But, you know, there's a proportion of roads that cut tunnels through the earth, through mountainsides, that some of it will be preserved by landslips and so on. So we are talking about a small amount, but when you think about it in the context of the entire planet, the prospect for even small sections of roads to be preserved and perhaps to hint at the greater network, the greater connection of places that we know today, I think is quite a striking prospect, and the possibility that might tell stories about the kind of connected world that we live in.
Just to give an example to the audience of the kind of literature references that you bring into this book, in this chapter, you talk about the Nigerian novelist Ben Okri and the giant called King of the Road. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, this is from Ben Okri's novel, The Famished Road, and he tells a kind of fairy tale, a fable of the road, which tells the story of this figure called the King of the Road, which is like, he's like a great kind of source of appetite, a personification of appetite, and he just consumes everything that comes across his path, and the people who are kind of subject to his tyranny, you know, have to kind of placate him, leaving offerings, and he just consumes everything that they give to him until ultimately he begins to consume himself. Until all that's left is this stomach, this aching stomach, deep in the earth, still yearning to consume. And it seemed to me a really evocative way to think about roads, because we travel down roads every day and tend not to think about the space we're inhabiting, where we're passing through. But, you know, roads are conduits connecting desires. You know, so much of the consumption that we're embroiled in now is dependent on roads. That there is a sense in which I think roads describe a kind of insatiability, that is so much a part of the problem of that we're dealing with right now.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Farrier, who teaches at the University of Edinburgh. We're talking about his book. It's really an interesting book, Footprints in Search of Future Fossils. There's some places you visited that I've not been to, that your descriptions just really, they were like reading a J.G. Ballard novel. And Ballard is one of the people that you reference in your book. And I want to talk specifically about Shanghai, which is actually very close to J.G. Ballard. You went to the city of Shanghai, and it's a fever dream of a city, which is how you describe it. Talk to me about it. It seems just like it's one overgrown skyscraper collection. Yeah, I mean, it seems bizarre. It's like out of some kind of dystopian future.
Yeah, I mean, Shanghai is incredible. I went to Shanghai because I wanted to get a more tangible sense of how a city, like one of the biggest cities in the world, might leave an impression in the strata, or might leave a fossil of a kind. And it's such an energetic, vibrant, exciting place. It was just a really extraordinary experience to be there and just get a taste of that city. But yeah, it is very likely to leave a fossil layer that will still be there 100 million years from now. And this is largely from a combination of factors. First of all, the fact that Shanghai, which has a population of something like 24 to 26 million people, is sinking. It's sunk by well over 2 meters in the past 100 years. Yeah, and this is partly from them drawing water from the ground, and partly from building on very soft ground. So the fact that Shanghai is sinking is one reason, but another reason, of course, is sea level rise, and a city that is going down, as it were, you know, when the seas are going up, you know, facing the future. Ultimately of inundation. And, you know, there are all kinds of extraordinary engineering ideas to ward off sea level rise. Hopefully will work for a time. But, you know, I think the ultimate fate of coastal cities like Shanghai is of inundation. And from that point, it's simply a case of time and pressure, you know, as the fossil layer of the city goes deeper and gets compressed.
In that way, it's very much like Venice. And Venice has been going through this history for hundreds of years. Venice is also built on water. And they keep trying to prop it up, but it's sort of like, you know, it's like the myth of Sisyphus. I mean, you keep rolling the boulder up, and it keeps rolling back down.
Yeah, and Venice, is also facing a very precarious future where sea level rise is concerned. We were speaking earlier about the kind of literary analogues in the text. One of the literary references I make in the chapter on Shanghai and the fate of cities is to Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, which is a kind of series of incredible vignettes of these fantastical cities that supposedly Marco Polo has visited and that he's describing to the Kublai Khan in the course of his journeys. But Calvino says at one point that, you know, every single city that Marco Polo describes, and some of them are built from spiders' webs, or cities that exist only on stilts. They're incredible feats of the imagination. He says they're all saying something about Venice. The possibility is that Venice may be the first city that is lost to sea level rise. Again, you know, this is something we hope won't come to pass. But if so, it's likely then that every city that faces a similar fate will in a sense be telling a story that's already been told about Venice.
There's a moment in the Shanghai chapter where you go to the top of Shanghai Tower.
Yeah.
And look out, and it's endless city as far as you could see. And as a person who likes the outdoors and likes more natural environments, that to me just struck like an incredibly dystopian note, that it was like, oh my God, you know, we're just going to build everything as far as the eye could see. And that's going to be our legacy, which is not going to last long.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think, I mean, there's a dystopian dimension to that, but that's really not what I found when I was exploring our future fossils, or thinking about what they might be, because in some cases there are traces that we can confidently predict will be there in terms of the carbon in the atmosphere, as I've said, and so on. But in a lot of these cases, they're foretold, you know, they're predicted, but they haven't yet come to pass. And one of the things I became really passionate about in writing Footprints was that, you know, we can still take hold of the story that we're going to tell, the legacy that we're going to leave, that this is an opportunity for us to think about how we want to be remembered.
So you really hold out a note of hope.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to. I think the hope is there.
That's amazing. Okay, I'm impressed. I actually literally am impressed by that, David. I think that's amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, but
our track record isn't that great. I mean, it's our track record does not point to hope.
Well, yeah, I mean, the trajectory has been going in the wrong direction, certainly. But at the same time, we have to believe that not everything is done and dusted. You know, we have to believe that it's possible to arrest that trajectory, to find a better path forward. We're not going to arrest all the damage. We're not going to, you know, we will leave a legacy. We will leave a trace. But we can decide, you know, the kind of trace that is. We can decide, I think, are we going to leave a legacy that's one our descendants will honor us for, or convict us over?
Some of the places you visit are they remind me of Italo Calvino's writing on Kalo, Finland. One of the strangest places I have ever read of. Talk to me about what that is.
Yeah, so on Kalo is Finland's solution to the problem of storing nuclear waste safely for the long term. And by the long term, I mean at least 10,000 years, more like, you know, 250,000. This is a material which we know is deadly and immensely long-lived. And the Finn solution is possibly counterintuitive. In other parts of the world, particularly, you know, I'm thinking of the United States, there are plans to create repositories for this material and to mark where those repositories are in such a way that even in 10,000 years, it will still be evident to whoever comes across them that something lethal is buried there to stay away.
This is where your book got really fascinating, because here in New Mexico and near Carlsbad, where we're burying the nuclear waste, people get concerned with what you call, and I love this term, nuclear semiotics. How do we signpost this dangerous material for thousands of years from now? And there was a huge discussions about that.
Yeah. Going back into the 1980s, discussions about how do you communicate the danger of a site when, you know, language will have changed, you know, beyond what we can predict, that almost nothing of the language we use today, the visual grammar that we employ, will carry any fixed meaning. And so the solution in Carlsbad is to create this landscape of monuments, obelisks, you know, indicating that this is somewhere significant, but to indicate that it's somewhere deadly, because, you know, as I said, language will erode. All words have a half-life. Ironically,
wow.
They decided to use a kind of symbolic language drawn from, in part, Edvard Munch's painting The Scream, which so many of your listeners will be familiar with.
They start talking. I mean, there's the idea of an atomic priesthood, so that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years from now, myths will build up about this place.
Yeah, well, this was one of the suggestions. I don't think it's one that they're actually going to implement, but it was suggested by a semiotician named Thomas Seebach, that they should create this atomic priesthood that would be the guardians of a kind of mythologized information about nuclear waste, where it's stored, why it's dangerous, and so on, and that they would pass this information on a kind of every three generations or so, updating it according to the ways in which, you know, norms and language and so on had changed, and therefore creating a kind of relay through deep time. So there are all kinds of plans to, or ideas for how we communicate the danger of nuclear waste to the deep future. But in Finland, that approach is the complete opposite.
I know this was I find, when I read that, I was just struck. Like, yeah, their thing is to not post anything.
Yeah, yeah, just to bury it and leave it and let nature grow over the top and trust that it will be forgotten about, which seems incredible. But when you think about, you know, the pyramids and the fact that whenever, you know, humans have come across something that looks interesting, we tend to sort of take that our curiosity have its head. You know, we've broken into the tombs, we've looked for the treasure wherever we thought it might be. The risk of intrusion seems pretty great. And so I think, you know, there's something in that, in thinking, well, maybe just allowing it to fade. Maybe. But, you know, we won't know.
What
generation will never know.
What was interesting in your book is you tying together the great Finnish epic, and I'm probably not going to pronounce this correct, the Kalevala?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was, again, that's what, one of the things that makes your book so fascinating, is that you're able to bring this to the description. When I was reading about that, and I was familiar with it, but what's the Sampo? 'Cause do we know what that is?
No, well, the Finnish epic, the Kalevala, is really a kind of, it's a patchwork of poems stitched together. So it's not quite a kind of long epic narrative and continuous narrative in the manner of the Iliad, but it does hold together still, and throughout it there are references to this mythical object, the Sampo, and it's never really fully described. It's kind of like a mill, but really we're not told what it is, but it's often referred to as the bright lid, the shining bright lid, and it's thought to be the source of immense power, that it will bring wealth to whoever possesses it. And it really struck me as something that resonated with nuclear waste, as something that could come to be seen as treasure, you know, wealth buried by people who have no idea about the kind of the toxic legacies that we've left behind.
Wow.
And in fact, when I went to Onkalo and visited the repository, which I don't think I've mentioned, is buried 500 meters deep in the Finnish bedrock.
My God.
In bedrock, in granite bedrock that's nearly 2 billion years old. It's an incredible feat of engineering. But their plan for storing the waste is in this network, this warren or honeycomb of deposition tunnels. And in each one, they'll bury a copper canister filled with ceramic rods of this nuclear waste. And when we went to visit one of these tunnels, they opened up the concrete lid on one of the holes, and there at the bottom, gleaming in the torchlight, was this bright, shining copper lid of this 8-meter deposition canister. And it was the spookiest experience I've ever had, is to stand in that tunnel and see for a moment what it might be like for a future visitor eons from now to excavate that tunnel and to open it up again after millennia and see that bright light shining. And think, you know, if the Kalevala is still circulating, if it's still part of Finnish culture, would they think they'd found the source of the myth? Would they think they'd found the sample at last? It was an incredible moment.
It was an amazing place to read your description of being there. We only have a few minutes left. And I wanted to ask you about libraries. Libraries seem very tenuous, that nothing will be left of our libraries, especially now since everything is going to go digital and it's so easy to damage digital stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there are various kinds of libraries in footprints. And one of the main libraries that I think about is held in the world's frozen places, is locked up in the ice. We can think about ice, you know, the ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland and so on, as an immense library locking up thousands and thousands of years of climate history and these tiny bubbles of air trapped in the ice. And of course, you know, much of that is being lost. So it's compelling to think that we have this immense archive of planetary history already there. And it includes, you know, detailed records of human history as well. You know, the scientists can read, they can read evidence of the cessation of lead smelting in Europe because of the Black Death in the Middle Ages in these ice cores. It's there, and you know the layers that we're laying down as well in the ice. You know, the entries that we're putting into this library, you know, through the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere and so on. It's all there. And yet so much of it is being lost because of our actions, because of the way we're heating the planet and melting the ice.
And again, I want to mention to the audience, you visited one of the repositories for all those core samples.
Yeah. So I was in Australia for a time and was fortunate enough to go to Hobart in Tasmania and visit a laboratory that's working with cores from Antarctica and talk to the scientists there. And they themselves said, you know, we think about ice as an archive. We think about it as a library.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And to hold a core as well was an incredible experience, just to feel the weight of it and the incredible color. It's a beautiful object. The piece that I held was quite recently formed, actually. I was told that it was about 30 or so years old, younger really than me. But to think about, you know, my life or just a life like mine kind of marbled through that ice was a really moving and remarkable moment again.
We're completely out of time. We could talk about this book for hours. My guest tonight is David Farrier, who teaches at the University of Edinburgh. And we're talking about his book, Footprints, In Search of Future Fossils. David, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.